Good afternoon, or morning, depending on where you are. Welcome to the 2012 Retail Marketing Virtual Conference and Expo. I'm Melissa Campanelli, Editor-in-Chief of Retail Online Integration, and I'm pleased to welcome you to another great session, Going Global, How Retailers Can Take Advantage of the Global E-Commerce Opportunity. U.S. retailers are finally getting serious about going global. In fact, according to some recent surveys, more and more e-commerce firms report that international sales now account for more than 10% of their total online revenue. And firms at which international online sales is in the 5% to 10% range have jumped a whopping 43% in 2011. However, a large group of retailers have yet to exploit the global opportunity fully, as many international shoppers who want to buy from them still face a lot of challenges. So how can retailers make it easier for these would-be customers to buy from them? Well, we're lucky today because we have Jim Okamura, Managing Partner at Okamura Consulting and a noted international e-commerce expert who will guide you through some hard-to-navigate international e-commerce waters in today's session. You'll learn market intelligence and evaluating the opportunity of international. You'll learn about different cross-border e-commerce business models. You'll learn some common retailer challenges and solutions and some global e-commerce trends to watch. Let me just briefly tell you a little bit about Jim. Jim has more than 20 years of consulting experience focused on the retail industry, including strategic planning, branding, private label, consumer behavior, and multi-channel work. His work in multi-channel retail strategies has resulted in industry-leading thinking on retailer best practices and strategic planning. Jim's most recent publications are titled International E-Commerce Expansion Benchmarking, a framework for helping retailers analyze their goals and strategies to expand internationally, and Shop.org's Organizing for Cross-Channel Retailing, Benchmarks Organization Designed for Cross-Channel Retailing. Additional publications include Retail Details, Best Practices in Multi-Channel Integration, and the Shop.org Multi-Channel Retail Report. Jim was also recently elected an inaugural member of Shop.org's think tank, and this select group of digital retail thought leaders is designed to help the association members understand the role of digital retail in the future. It's really, really interesting. Clients of Jim's include Land's End, Gap, Mark's Work Warehouse, Microsoft, Williams-Sonoma, The Body Shop, Timberland, Sears, and on and on. Before we get started, however, let me just point out a few tips on how to make the most of today's dynamic presentation. First, if you have any technical difficulties and are viewing this webcast as part of the live day, please visit us in the information booth to get some help. If you're viewing on demand, please shoot us an email at virtualshowinfo@napco.com and someone will get back to you promptly. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can use all of the widgets and bells and whistles on the console. And speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the top Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on the console do and how you can customize your experience today. You could even tweet from the console. Lastly, if you leave the session at any time or would like to view it again later, you can access the entire presentation from the auditorium in the Retail Marketing Virtual Show on-demand environment, which will be open for 3 months beginning on Monday, April 23rd. With that, take it away, Jim.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Melissa, and thanks to the audience for attending the show. As Melissa mentioned, I'm going to take you through some of the insights and experience that we have gained through a lot of the work that we're doing for generally bigger brands. But make no mistake, you know, what we're talking about here in terms of international e-commerce is something that is available to all types of retailers, whether you're small or large. We'll talk through that as we share some of our frameworks here. The goals of today's presentation, you know, really are to share our, you know, our insights on where, what retailers' challenges are, the strategies and solutions that they're really using now to capture some of this global e-commerce demand. What this is not going to be is a data review on all the growth in a lot of different, you know, international markets. Certainly there is a lot of data out there, and I would encourage, you know, all to you know, really understand, you know, what is available to you. But for today, we thought that it's going to be most helpful to be able to, if you're a retailer, understand, you know, what are some of the business model options out there, you know, both now as well as, you know, a little further into the future. And if you're a key business partner to the retailers, there are so many barriers and challenges that the retailer has to deal with when it comes to international that we often think it's an area that a lot of these key business partners can provide solutions for these retailers. So, with that, let me give you a quick, you know, background on our firm. I'm the managing partner for Okamura Consulting. As Melissa mentioned, we've been doing retail strategic planning work for a long time. We really focus on, you know, not only e-commerce, but really it's a retail channel integration. It's something that, you know, we have been focused on, you know, how in what used to be called multi-channel retail, and we now really define this as cross-channel retail strategies, that coordinated effort, you know, between business teams that's making it a seamless customer experience for the shopper. In a sense, we know that is still yet to come. You know, we're still very early in those days, but that's what really, I think, makes our industry very exciting at this point. And an area that, you know, we have found ourselves, you know, really doing a lot of work has been on the international stage. In some cases, for big global brands who are expanding into Asia-Pacific or Europe, or for European brands, you know, looking to come over to the U.S., so that's really where we've been doing a lot of work in international or global planning. And we'll, again, share some of the insights that we're seeing, you know, with a number of these clients in some of the coming slides. So with that, here is the agenda that we're going to be covering today. We wanted to just quickly talk towards, you know, what is that current snapshot? Where are we with international? And then, you know, we'll describe what we see as being the stages for international expansion. Two of those stages, you know, we will really sort of focus on, you know, one which is a cross-border e-commerce or what we call a participatory stage. And then the active stage strategies, you know, really tends to be more for the big global brands. But, again, it's good to understand how these global brands are really tackling the international challenge. In a lot of the benchmark work that we have been doing, some of these big thought leadership studies, we've often tried to focus on, well, what are those barriers? What are the challenges that retailers are dealing with? And that's where we know the list is long, and you know, the good thing is that the solutions are also, you know, really coming to bear as well. And that's something that, you know, we'll try to match up some of those challenges with the solutions that we're seeing in the market. And I'll finish off on just what we see as being global trends to watch for, you know, and again, this is whether you are currently selling overseas or whether you're still in those early stages of deciding, is this right for us? So, again, you know, without going into a lot of the data, you know, we certainly see why international e-commerce has, in our opinion, tipped, you know, where we are seeing so many more U.S.-based retailers really looking at how do we capture some of that demand. And I think this, you know, growth forecast on the global map kind of, you know, says that we all know, you know, that while the U.S., you know, e-commerce market, the domestic e-commerce market has remained very healthy and, again, you know, the best place in retail to be, as we always like to say. We also know it's decelerating. We're no longer enjoying those 20-25% a year annual growth in e-commerce in the domestic economy. And you can see where, you know, the growth is happening. I mean, Europe is somewhat in the same boat, at least Western Europe. It's clearly in some of the emerging markets, whether you're looking at, you know, that Asian number, which is hugely influenced by the Chinese market, or if you were looking to Brazil, where the economy has been, you know, very strong there in retail, and e-commerce is certainly at a different stage of growth there. But that's really where, you know, there is such upside demand in global e-commerce that it's got a lot of attention, but it gets much more difficult once you start to really be thinking about how do we capture that. So, you know, I've just pulled up a few, I'll show a few examples here, you know, what we think of as e-retailers who have really built their business for international. We often like to share some of the Threadless story. Most of you probably are aware of, you know, Threadless.com and their crowdsourcing business model, which has garnered a lot of attention. But they've been very generous in sort of sharing just what an international customer base they really have. To the point where, you know, they have gone public saying that, you know, roughly 60% of their total business comes from customers who are not in the U.S. So you see, companies like that doing a tremendous amount of international, and I will say that's probably the high water mark that we have seen. But think of, you know, here's another company that we know of, Sous Vide Supreme. Selling a very niche product, you know, essentially water-based ovens. And so for any foodie out there who is interested, regardless where they live, I mean, these are very specific items that they're looking for. So clearly the unique product, you know, has been something that has helped Sous Vide Supreme sell a lot of their product outside of the U.S. market. Or, you know, a company like StyleTrek, based out of New York, which is really trying to showcase a lot of up-and-coming designers by using different regions of the world, you know, where these designers are coming from to kind of showcase the attract an international customer base. But certainly it's coming from the other direction, too. So if we look at, you know, e-retailers from other countries, Isabella Oliver, again, great example of a pure play e-commerce retailer, really building their brand online, really carving out a strong following, you know, with their maternity wear in particular. But they are, you know, doing a lot of business in the U.S. and in other marketplaces as they continue to expand globally. Or if you looked at the Italian-based Yuke's.com in really the luxury fashion space, this is a company that was really built, you know, by global logistics executives. Their international profile is very impressive, whether you're looking at back office, you know, functionality or, again, who they're selling to. And then you take, you know, like a manufacturer like Phil and Ted's, New Zealand, you know, company. The manufacturers, we are fully expecting to really join the global e-commerce party in coming years. And certainly we know a lot who are trying to develop their capabilities, you know, that are aligned across their global distribution. So again, just some ideas, lots of examples, but here's how we like to try to characterize where international e-commerce is. You know, this is a very familiar life cycle curve, you know, for many of you, you know, where we place. I'll point out a few things here. I mean, where we place the domestic e-commerce box is obviously getting towards, you know, the top. We are certainly becoming a mature domestic e-commerce economy. Compare that to cross-channel retailing, the integrated strategies that are really only hitting now. We like to think of e-commerce being 15 years old and cross-channel really being 5 years old. And we're still seeing, you know, very early days there. Well, that's where if you look at mobile commerce or international e-commerce, you know, we're certainly at, you know, still those emerging stages. So certainly what we're seeing now really is, you know, that proverbial tip of the iceberg. What we tried to you know, put in here is just an example coming out of the apparel industry. So the apparel industry in the U.S. is roughly a $200 billion business. It has more or less, you know, been a flat, you know, business over the number of years. It might grow 1 or 2% a year, but, you know, of that $200 billion, obviously apparel has been a strong category online, and that's where, you know, we expect to see the domestic e-commerce marketplace to probably grow to somewhere around $35 billion. of that $200 billion. Cross-channel retail has that a potential to impact a much broader swath of that total $200 billion. But, you know, where we've started to place, you know, some numbers, some market sizing against, you know, international, you know, we're sort of forecasting somewhere in that 8 to 10%, you know, or 8 to 10 billion range over the next few years. We have sized the international market. We've seen ComScore data that suggests somewhere around 6% of the total U.S. e-commerce marketplace is actually being sold overseas. We actually think it's a little bit higher, maybe 6 to 8%, you know, in a large part because this is very tricky to market size, and I'll talk about that shortly. Here's the model that we have developed over time, and this came from extensive research where we have talked to and interviewed a lot of retailers, whether they're small or large, in terms of what are their different international e-commerce strategies. And this will be a quick history lesson in a sense, because if we think of as recently as 3 to 4 years ago, most companies, most retailers were doing nothing, you know, or very little in terms of helping out that overseas shopper. And generally that is what characterizes the passive approach. In a passive approach, the retailer is providing some international shipping options, but largely the customer is on their own. And I'll come back to the middle stage, participatory, but the active stage strategy was always sort of the realm of the very big brands, those who could really build in-country capabilities, a fully landed business, including back-end, you know, like logistics and fulfillment capabilities, multilingual call center capabilities, and, you know, again, really know how to drive demand, drive, you know, generate revenue in these overseas markets. But again, that was always sort of the realm of the very largest brands. What has happened over the last 3 to 4 years is this emergence of this middle ground. We called it a participatory strategy, but we also call it cross-border e-commerce. And, you know, we really give a lot of the solution providers, the cross-border vendors, a ton of credit for really driving this marketplace. Certainly what we see is that there have been a lot of, you know, retailers who have really decided that, you know, this is a good way for them to really start to grow their overseas customer base. Generally, how we describe this this stage is that there is some solution that is often bundling some logistics and operations capabilities to ship the product overseas, sometimes return capabilities or customer care, usually bundled with some technology solution such as an international shopping cart. So again, at least the customer is starting to see the product, you know, in their local currency, their preferred currency. And I'll describe some of this in the next slide to give you a little better sense of these three stages. So again, for starters, you know, just with the revenue potential, international as a percentage of the total e-commerce business, these are clearly guidelines only. You know, the Threadless case is a clear example as we've worked with them over the years. They really did nothing to help that that overseas customers, and yet while they were doing nothing, they were able to really hit 40 to 50% of their business was overseas. In recent years, they've started to add some capabilities that really characterize that next stage, the participatory stage. So again, you know, they've hit 60%. It doesn't say that every company can do that, but use these as guidelines only. Really what it comes down to, we think, is, you know, investment and, you know, what companies are willing to risk when it comes to international expansion, because certainly a common theme we've heard throughout all of our discussions, you know, and work with the various retailers is that international is a long payback. It's going to take a long time. You know, companies have to be really patient and really strategic in that sense if they're going after this business. So again, from the operating model that you see in front of you right now, you can sort of see what I was describing earlier, that we do characterize, you know, the retailers in that participatory stage as, you know, having a really tactical focus on, you know, how do we assist that international customer. We're still, you know, I'll talk more towards what we call this early stages of marketing and merchandising that's tailored towards, you know, that local customer. But clearly it does improve the customer experience, and we see that certainly in terms of conversion rates. You know, as these capabilities are added to you know, a retailer's operations, the customers are feeling more comfortable with that, you know, like buy decision. Again, the active stage, you know, we'll talk about that shortly, because again, that tends to be very complicated. Bigger the company, more complex. But overall, we've been seeing cross-border e-commerce really has been thriving over the last couple of years. You know, you can look at, you know, certainly some of the demand factors, the consumer side of things. You know, the global online shopper is growing every day, that addressable marketplace, and it's certainly coming from both mature and emerging markets. In general, the core strategies that we would, you know, see most retailers focusing on are, you know, these consumers are seeking brands they know and love. In often case, they are seeking that unique product, like the sous vide water oven. There's a price value component, no doubt, but there's also some interesting, you know, strategies that I think are being community based or lifestyle based that really cut across political boundaries. And I think that's really, you know, creating very interesting opportunities for companies like Isabella Oliver, who is, you know, trying to really carve out a niche within the maternity apparel wear. You know, overall, we've done the research, we've done focus groups, we've done surveys with, you know, these overseas shoppers, and it really is interesting to see how they're so frustrated with the shopping experience. So in a lot of cases, you know, even if we have reached 6 to 8% of the total e-commerce market is now international, the consumer, you know, wants the products so badly that they are willing to put up, you know, with subpar shopping experiences compared to that domestic shopper, and that's what really sort of excites us about this opportunity, is that despite all these challenges, the consumers are still voting with their dollars. If we start to address some of these customer experience glitches, let's say, you know, we certainly feel that there's so much more upside. Where is this the sales happening? You know, the right hand side kind of, you know, clearly shows that, and we see this echoed by a lot of the retailers' priority markets. It does start with the English speaking markets first. Canada is a huge part of it. No doubt this also swings, you know, quite a bit with foreign exchange rates. So the Australian market has been one to really watch, as their dollar has become, you know, much stronger, certainly against, you know, the U.S. dollar, but also against the euro. The Australian shoppers have been rabid for buying in a cross-border e-commerce fashion. So certainly that's where, you know, where we're seeing early stage, you know, focus on English-speaking markets. As you get into other markets, it becomes, you know, certainly the complexity starts to increase. Here's, you know, just a little illustration that we've used to kind of show where we're at now. So the You Are Here icon is kind of hidden. It's the little red X there. Again, we're looking at a typical kind of life cycle curve. It's interesting for us, as we've, you know, really talked to a lot of these, you know, retailers in terms of their international or cross-border e-commerce efforts, and it really reminds us of the early days, you know, in the mid-90s of e-commerce. You know, the international team, quote-unquote, you know, is really a Skunk Works project that's tucked somewhere in the corner of the building. Maybe it's, you know, a quarter or half-time of one person's job. It's not very well-funded. You know, it's something that, you know, despite all these challenges, we're still seeing a lot of this very high growth. Part of this challenge really does relate to how big will big be, right? What is the size of the prize or the market sizing and forecasting? And because this is a very tricky market, again, to really size, you know, we've seen, you know, some of the ComScore data. We worked with, you know, practically all the credit card companies. Credit card companies look at this from where the credit card was issued. So even if it has a U.S. ship-to address, it may be counted as an overseas purchase. And then you get the challenge of, you know, some of the international freight forwarding business models, and I'll talk about that in a couple of slides forward. But, you know, these are packages that are destined for an overseas shopper, but, you know, have a staging ground somewhere in the U.S. So again, you know, the selling retailer, again, you know, just has a U.S. ship-to address, but those are most definitely are going towards an international customer. So again, market sizing tends to be very tricky in this, and you know, as we know, market sizing should dictate, you know, what some of the strategic options really are. So what else we're trying to express in this slide, it really has been, you know, we've been very critical that you know, a lot of retailers are not thinking longer term. They've really been focused on, you know, operational issues. Again, nothing wrong with that because no one wants to promise something and then not be able to deliver upon that promise. So we kind of characterize the last few years as being, you know, really focused on operations. How do we get the product, you know, to and from the end customer? How do we get payments, you know, handled? How do we deal with fraud? You know, how do we deal with, you know, a lot of the back office supply chain functions? And, you know, again, that's really where I think the effort has been, and perhaps that is the right thing to do. But now that we're kind of emerging out of this operational focus, you know, we really see this next stage as doing what good retailers do, create demand. We're now entering this marketing stage, you know, where the steepness of the curve is going to be totally dependent on how do we create demand. And this has been a challenge for us in working with a lot of global brands, is finding local market marketing expertise. You know, again, very specific to e-commerce, someone that, you know, knows how to drive, you know, the volume of business. And we've looked to global agency networks, and they have not, you know, been good solutions. So again, we're urging a lot of, you know, companies, who vendors essentially to the retailers who are looking to add international marketing services, that the demand definitely is coming for those types of services. As far as different business models go, we've kind of broken down the cross-border e-commerce businesses into four distinct business models. A lot of companies, a lot of retailers and manufacturers, again, are really choosing to outsource this. We kind of call these sell and ship models. 51 is clearly, you know, become the market leader in terms of, you know, this type of an option. You know, yet we see some retailers or brands, again, having kind of a mixed portfolio where they really are taking it on a country-by-country or regional basis, depending upon some of their existing distribution assets, wholesale, for example, or where, again, they are pushing, you know, traffic to their local country partners as opposed to really trying to sell it online. So, again, some are taking that more thoughtful approach and really looking at it as a mixed portfolio. Others are really using, again, these international package forwarders, you know, so you can buy from any site, have a U.S. ship-to destination, and then, you know, and then it gets shipped overseas, you know, when the economics work a little bit better. What's been interesting for us as we've looked at retailers both in the U.S. as well as in the Europe, particularly the more mature UK market, is that you see how the U.S. retailers, in this case, are not ahead of the game. You see how the UK retailers in particular have taken on a much more do-it-yourself model. And that's because, you know, for the most part, the UK retailers have been selling internationally for much longer than U.S. retailers. It's a fact of life if you're part of the EU. you're going to ship across borders, you want to sell across borders. I mean, it's a very hot political topic in terms of cross-border e-commerce within the European Union. So in general, we see a lot of, you know, retailers relying less upon outsourced models and trying to figure it out themselves. Of course, you know, with the help of shippers, you know, whether they're the big global brands like UPS, FedEx, DHL, or whether they're more local specialists. But again, different models, again, for different needs. And we are often thinking that the cross-border model, at least for some of the bigger brands, is really a stepping stone. It's a staging ground for them to prove out the international demand, feel more confident, you know, with their market sizing estimates, and that they will eventually get to this type of a portfolio map. So this is really an example of a hybrid business model for a global brand and how they might look at, well, what is that, you know, financial potential, the size of the prize? Because that, in a sense, is going to dictate, you know, whether we have enough business there to really develop a fully landed business in a region or a country, an active stage strategy, as depicted on the far right-hand side. But some countries, again, are going to fall in that middle ground. I mean, if there is, you know, call it less than a $20 million, maybe even less than a $50 million opportunity for some of these big global brands, then, it may not be worth their while to develop that fully active stage strategy. And that cross-border may be the best way to, again, capture that demand while limiting their upfront investment in the fully active stage strategy. You know, for active stage strategies, again, for a lot of these big brands, you know, a lot of it does come back to organization design. How are different brands, again, with a global footprint, really looking at having, what we characterize as strong or weak centers of excellence? So in a very strong, centralized model, they're really developing as much of this, you know, from the center as possible, and at a country level, they're merely executing. There is no right or wrong here. In that decentralized, model, we see, again, you know, a lot of companies that have set up very strong country level or regional capabilities, and so they give, you know, like a lot of autonomy to those country managers to, again, tailor the sales programs, you know, for each marketplace. So, again, very decentralized, you know, where the web center of excellence really is a shared resource model. They're taking direction from the country leaders. The models that we find most interesting, again, are really this hybrid, you know, where, again, they're trying to get the best of both. They're trying to have a very strong central leadership, but still allow the local countries or regions to have, you know, some customization capabilities. So they can tailor everything from the product mix to how they're speaking to the customers and marketing to them to how they, again, fulfill orders and handle customer care in the way that's suitable to that marketplace and not, you know, forcing upon them, you know, standards that we would, you know, place for a U.S. customer. So again, a lot of the bigger the company and those who are really looking at these active stage strategies, they're really looking at issues of, you know, how centralized or not, you know, should we be. And again, this is work we've done, you know, on organization design for, so this is kind of an example of a big global brand where there is a global e-commerce VP who has like the global web center underneath, you know, that person, but, you know, and then they would have a small e-commerce teams in each region or country. It's very similar to the model that we see with multi-brand companies as well, where again, there is a need for a strong center. But again, to have specialists who are dedicated to either a brand or a region is important. And note, again, the analogy to the CMO's role and how they would, of course, have local country or regional marketing capabilities. So we're seeing a lot of this focus on, well, how will we structure this so that, you know, we're aligning our organization, you know, with our chosen strategy. I'll spend just a few more, you know, minutes here talking towards some of the challenges and barriers. I mean, at the heart of this, you know, we often find, and this is, I think, is particularly so with, you know, manufacturers, that trying to get the right balance between, you know, brand and commerce. And as we know, I mean, the quote from Jamie Nordstrom, who heads up Nordstrom's e-commerce business, you know, it's hard to again, as we know, grow e-commerce without, you know, being highly promotional, a call to action. And so, again, you know, who will win that battle, the brand guardians or the commerce, you know, people who are trying to drive revenues? That's central to a lot of the internal debate that's happening at a lot of companies. How do you, again, manage customer experience and content management becomes so critical on a global stage? So, again, what you're seeing there in front of you are just different faces of Louis Vuitton, you know, clearly using, you know, a certain standardized template that allows, you know, to tailor the content to the local marketplace. Whether or not it's commerce, you know, commerce enabled, you know, really is beside the point. A lot of this is, how do you again, you know, create this, you know, where you're managing a consistent customer experience that again the brand folks will again approve, but also again help drive commerce. And then, you know, the content that we know that everyone seems to be chasing after to really, you know, create that rich shopping experience becomes one of those issues where, yes, some of it can be centralized, but, yes, some of it needs to be localized. And that again, you know, is going to be a very tricky balancing act for a lot of the companies. You know, what we see with, you know, a company like with Nordstrom, and Nordstrom, you know, we think they've done the best implementation of 51. So again, they spell it out very clearly in terms of, you know, how they are now selling to overseas customers, and you will see how they are pricing in, you know, the local currency, and they walk you through the process so that, you know, you, when you're checking out, you clearly know that you're in 51's cart. But, you know, true to Nordstrom's famous service culture, again, they're trying to make this as good of an experience as possible, not confusing for the shopper. So as we've been working with a number of global brands and looking at, you know, multiple continent capabilities, trying to have e-commerce up and running in Europe, the North America or the U.S. market, as well as Asia, we've been happy to find that, you know, we're finding digital agency partners that, you know, have multiple offices and are experienced now at, you know, working, you know, with across different countries. That's been very encouraging for us. And at the same time, the operating partners, technology and operating solutions, whether it's platform or logistics and call center. Likewise, there's been a tremendous movement to for a lot of these companies, whether they're U.S.-based or European-based. They're forming partnerships. They're adding capabilities that really allow them to serve global customers. Again, Asia tends to be a separate, you know, issue, separate types of solutions. China even more so. Again, like there's very few integrated capabilities that. But definitely when we're looking at U.S. and Europe, we're seeing so many more of these kinds of capabilities. And that doesn't even get into what we, you know, these cross-border e-commerce providers. You know, at last count, we I think there was something like 20 of them that we've seen at some of the bigger shows. You know, we clearly acknowledge 51 as being a market leader, you know, but you know, and underlying their capabilities is, you know, big companies like Pitney Bowes. But there's also other models like consumer-facing models like Borderlinks. And then you get into a whole litany of regional specialists. You know, whether you're looking at Taobao, you know, for the Chinese market, or you're looking to go into Latin America or Brazil, or certain Asian countries, we see all sorts of like specialists who are really helping facilitate that cross-border e-commerce sale. So again, the development of these types of solution providers really has, you know, given a boost to the overall industry. And you know, again, largely we could say that, you know, we've reached that 6 to 8% of total U.S. e-commerce, you know, based upon pent-up demand. So here is actually an edited list of barriers to international, and there's a much, much longer list that we have that really is, you know, kind of captures all the things that retailers have said, you know, are likely to trip you up. in your international journey. I'll point out, you know, like a few things, you know, here. Again, we're probably short on time, so we can't spend a whole lot of time here. But certainly, for a lot of, you know, companies, getting that you know, brand versus commerce kind of debate going, and understanding how organization, you know, needs to change. How do you properly resource for this international opportunity? Those to us are big strategic, you know, issues. You know, merchandising, you know, is something that, you know, we have learned over time, certainly from best practice leaders, that again, you have to be really close to the market. You cannot, you know, just simply take the same product that we're selling here and expect it's going to sell in a different marketplace. So how do you really change to those local tastes and preferences and sizes and all of that? Not to mention, again, you know, demand planning and pricing issues, which, you know, can be very tricky when you're still new to a marketplace. All sorts of issues, you know, in marketing, as I've kind of mentioned to us, that's still a weak spot overall in the global e-commerce journey. So we hope to see more solutions really coming out there. And again, from an operations side, I think we're getting better at that. And I think, you know, the solution providers are getting better. This is a bit of a volume, you know, issue that we are now through several cycles, several years. We're starting to see again, like, the operations kind of smoothing out and you know, establishing more standards. So again, the barriers are very lengthy and can go on and on. Certainly, you know, we'll save, you know, some of that for another time. So let me wrap up just, you know, in closing here. You know, just some of the trends that we're watching in terms of, you know, the global e-commerce sector. We are seeing so many more manufacturers really kind of getting their e-commerce act together, something that they're, you know, looking at domestically, but they're not just looking domestically. In a lot of cases, if they already have, you know, strong international distribution partners, they're looking at international e-commerce as well. And so we really expect to see the manufacturers really kind of, you know, step up to some of the And this may be how they justify competing directly against, you know, the retailers in a lot of cases. How global brands, you know, view the role of e-commerce is going to, again, be very interesting in coming years. I mean, what was once, again, that interesting direct digital kind of, you know, business is now squarely in the headlights of the executive committee's agenda. And we're seeing this, you know, really happening where on an international stage, where a lot of brands are looking to the e-commerce division as a leading indicator. So let's go into a marketplace where we have no stores or lack the offline distribution. Let's get a sense of, you know, how does our brand play out? How, you know, what kind of demand could we expect? How do we need to tweak, you know, the product mix? All those things that e-commerce can kind of be a leading indicator before a big global brand, you know, commits to the offline infrastructure of, you know, real estate and construction and all of that. We think that, you know, marketplaces, you know, again, marketplaces being obviously a hot topic in domestic, e-commerce in the U.S., you know, we see how less developed it is in a lot of, you know, other countries. You know, and yet there's always some niche marketplaces. So, again, a good entry point, a good way to sort of test things out. Again, getting that reach, kind of your online multi-channel approach, you know, it is something where we're encouraging, you know, look to where the local marketplaces are. It'll at least be a good, hopefully a good, you know, like, source of traffic. Certainly we expect to see more and more, like, overseas brands and retailers enter the U.S. market. So while we're having this discussion looking at how U.S. retailers go overseas, know that someone is doing the same and coming after our business over here. So again, don't be surprised to see more of that happening. You know, convergence, again, of different trends. I mean, we've been very bullish, you know, with tablet, you know, optimized e-commerce capabilities. Certainly we're not seeing this yet in a cross-border sense, but I would tend to think we'll see something that's coming up that's going to be optimized for tablets or iPads that really does focus on cross-border. And overall, I mean, we have seen a tremendous amount of mergers and acquisitions activity. We see a lot of, like, you know, big brands really stepping into this, and not just the customer-facing brands, but big infrastructure brands like a UPS or FedEx or MasterCard, again, putting some of their substantial muscle behind it. So we're going to see a lot of, you know, mergers and acquisition activity. We're going to see some consolidation in the industry, and that's going to create even more interesting solutions as more money goes chasing after this global e-commerce. So, again, we see this as being a very exciting time. You know, I thank you very much for your attention. And certainly, here's contact information if anyone has any further questions for us. Melissa, back to you.
Excellent presentation. Thanks so much, Jim. That was really detailed, and you gave a lot of great examples, and I'm sure our listeners got a lot out of it, especially if they're interested in going international. So on behalf of Retail Online Integration, I want to thank you again for attending the session, everybody. If you're interested in discussing anything that you heard during the presentation, we encourage you to visit the Networking Lounge to chat live with other session attendees, and you can also visit the info booth to fill out our show survey to let us know about your experience today. And also, if you're listening to this during the live event, check out the agenda for the rest of the day. We have several wonderful sessions lined up and encourage you to view as many as you can. Remember, if you can't watch them live, add them to your briefcase and view at your convenience in the on-demand environment. Have a great day, everybody.